Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight is part two of my three-part interview with Jenny Ashford about her new book, The Unseen Hand, which is a compilation of poltergeist cases through the ages. We'll delve into a bunch of these and some of the theories and thoughts I had surrounding them. And if you're a Patreon, you've already had part two and part three, as promised, as well as a little extra piece. The rest of you, you can hear part three next weekend. And if you want to become a patron, it's only $3 a month. I may eventually add another tier. I'm trying to think of exactly what I would add to make that worth it for people. Suggestions are always welcome. I have a handful of shows I'm hoping to put up this week on wheredidtheroadgo.com. Please, if you listen to us on iTunes or saying, throw us a rating, preferably a good one, but give us a rating on iTunes. I appreciate all the comments on YouTube. That is always something. I can't go through all of them. YouTube doesn't even tell me about all of them anymore. But I do try to go through as many of them as possible. And I do appreciate people leaving intelligent comments on our videos. All right, without any further ado, here's part two of my conversation with Jenny Ashford. So, Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
And this is going to be part two of, I think, three on your new book, The Unseen Hand.
Okay, yes.
Because there's a lot of stuff in here.
There really is. Like I said, it just, you know, I didn't realize it at the time I was writing it. I was just like, kept finding more and more stuff. I'm like, oh, I got to put that in. Oh, that's cool. I got to put that in. So, you know, it ended up being much longer than, you know, because I'm a completist. I wanted to try and get everything I could get in there.
Well, not only that, but it's not the same thing over and over again. I mean, you get some compilations like this and you're basically reading the same story with different people in each case. And that's not what you have here.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wanted to get a wide variety of stuff. You know, some of them are kind of similar, but, you know, they were different enough. If one of them was like pretty much exactly like another one, I usually just left it out.
Right. Right. And you go all the way back to, like, you know, 2000 years ago in some of these cases.
Yeah, there were some very, very old ones. I mean, obviously, the older it is, you know, the less information there was about it. But I kind of felt like I wanted to, you know, just show how far back this kind of phenomena goes.
Right.
Even if there wasn't a great deal of information from the time.
Just to establish it's something that's been happening throughout history.
Right. Yeah.
And that goes for a lot of paranormal phenomena. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say the UFO stuff started with Kenneth Arnold and such, but you know, there's so many cases going back through history of UFO sightings.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But all right, so we got up to your chapter on that you entitled Phantasmic Fluids, and that's water, oil, and blood.
Yes.
And that is a definitely a interesting combination.
Yes, I wanted to put all the liquids in one chapter. All the unusual liquids.
Now, you wrote a book, was it your last book that you wrote, or the second to last? The Rochdale Poltergeist was one of the ones you wrote that dealt with water.
Yeah, that was that happened in the mid-90s. And I wrote that with Steve Mara. And I think we did a show on it.
Yeah, you did. So,
yeah, it was one where there was, I mean, there were other, you know, poltergeist manifestations happening as well. But the main kind of focus of it was indoor rain, which was seen by many, many witnesses and was also witnessed when none of the family were in the home, you know, meaning that there probably wasn't any way for anyone to be faking it.
Yeah.
And also a sample of the water that was taken off the ceiling that spontaneously manifested on the ceiling. This sample had a huge electrical charge, like just off the charts. Yeah. So they, you know, it was different than they, because obviously they took a sample from the tap in the house too to compare. And that was just regular. But yeah, the one they got off the ceiling, this quote unquote paranormally generated water, was for some reason electrically charged to a, you know, to an amazing degree. What that, you know, what that could signify, who knows? But it's actually a very interesting piece of evidence.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. And let's talk about the Caledonia Hills one in Nova Scotia.
Caledonia Mills.
Oh, I had hills down.
Yeah.
Autocorrect.
Yeah, yeah. We've all fallen for that. That was actually, this was more a fire kind of case.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. That's why I was kind of confused because, you know, we had it under, but yeah, that was actually, that's called the fire spook of Caledonia Mills. So that's usually a fire case. So if you want to wait and talk about that in the fire case, we can talk about that in the fire case, or you can talk about it now if we want to.
Well, we could talk briefly about Don Decker, the Rain Man. You have mentioned him before, and he was actually able to control his rain ability.
Yeah, to an extent. He couldn't, I guess he couldn't do it at first because it sort of manifested spontaneously when he was on a furlough from prison. He was in prison for some minor, you know, it was just receiving stolen property or something like that.
Yeah.
He was given like a weekend furlough to go to his grandfather's funeral. Now, his relationship with his grandfather had been very contentious. He claims that his grandfather had abused him. So he was having kind of all these conflicting feelings about his grandfather's death, you know, being glad that he was dead, feeling guilty that he was glad that he was dead and whatnot. But he was staying with family friends, and while he was staying there, after he got home from the funeral, he saw kind of a vision of an old man. I don't believe he ever said he thought it was his grandfather, but he just did see a vision of an old man in the window, and he spontaneously got some cuts on his arms. And shortly afterward, when he came back downstairs for dinner, the family friends he was staying with said he started acting very strangely, like he was going into these weird trances and he was like staring off into space. And then suddenly it began raining in the house. And, you know, obviously the people were like, well, you know, there's a leak or something like that. And they checked out everything. They called the landlord came over, they called police came over, and no one could really figure out where the water was coming from. And a few of them saw raindrops going up, raindrops going to the side, which also happened in Rochdale. Steve Mara said he saw a few of the raindrops going upward as well. But this rain pretty much manifested wherever Don Decker went. He went to a pizza parlor later. They were trying to get him out of the house, and the woman who ran the pizza parlor said it started to rain in there as well. He also had other kind of manifestations. Pots would rattle when he walked by. He was once bodily picked up and thrown against a wall by an unseen force. And it didn't really get to the point where he thought he could control it until he got back to prison after his furlough was over. And at that point, I don't really think any of the prisoners had been, or the guards had been, particularly afraid of him before. But after he came back, they said he seemed different. And he would just sit in his cell and, you know, he had just this horrible look on his face, and he would go into these trances and things, and it would start to rain inside his cell. And several other prisoners and several of the guards also, you know, witnessed this. And one of the guards actually asked him, he's like, oh, well, if you can control it, then make it rain in the warden's office, which was, you know, way down the hall or like on the other side of the prison. And Don Decker said he could do that. And evidently there was some water fell from the ceiling and fell onto the warden's chest, and he didn't know where it had come from. So he tended to think, from reading interviews with Don Decker, he tended to think it had something to do with his grandfather. Either his grandfather had returned as an evil spirit to torment him, or he was possessed by some kind of a demon. And eventually, while he was in prison, they did get a priest to come and do an exorcism. And evidently, the manifestation stopped after that. He did seem to, it's strange because I've seen him interviewed several times about this, and he almost seemed to enjoy it at the time.
Yeah.
That, you know, that he could control this, but at the same time, he also understood that it wasn't good and it wasn't right for him to be doing that. So maybe he should get that fixed, you know? So it's kind of funny to watch him because he's a little bit creepy when he talks about it, but it didn't end up such a great story though. I mean, he got out of prison for that initial charge. That's when he was quite young, but many years later he was put in prison again because someone he knew that owned a restaurant hired him to set the restaurant on fire for the insurance. So both he and the restaurant owner got sent to prison for arson, which is kind of ironic in a way.
Yeah.
Well, and then arson.
you have a case from Atlanta, Georgia in 1987 of a blood poltergeist, and it goes around a 77-year-old woman.
Yes.
Which is highly unusual.
That is very unusual. And it was very random, and there didn't really seem to be any other manifestations. It was an elderly couple, you know, they had lived in the house apparently for quite a long time and had never had any problems. And it just happened that one night the woman got out of the shower and there was a puddle of blood on the bathroom floor. And at first she thought something had happened to her husband, that he'd been hurt or something, because he wasn't in the best of health. And she, you know, so she called out to him and things like that. And he came running in like, what's the matter? And he was fine, you know, totally clean, not bleeding, nothing. And she's like, look, there's blood all over the floor. And so they started searching the whole house and there was kind of blood everywhere. There was kind of puddles of it on the floor. It was on the wall. It was underneath the appliances, which I thought was the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was great volumes of it. I mean, as though someone had been murdered in there. And so they called the police to deal with it. And the police really couldn't figure it out either. They said, well, maybe a wounded animal got in and bled all over everything. It's like, you know, you guys obviously aren't hurt. There's no body in here. And, you know, but they couldn't find any animals. They couldn't really find anything else to explain it. And they actually took samples of the blood and had it analyzed. Now, the blood was human, but the blood type was not the same as either of the elderly couple's blood type.
Right. It was type O, and they both had type A.
Yes, that's right. So for a while, I don't think that the blood really recurred all that often. It kind of got pretty popular around town, you know, the Atlanta Blood House. Because for a while, the police sealed the house off because they said, well, we have to make sure that this isn't a crime scene. I mean, because there's so much blood in here. It's like, you guys could have killed someone and hid them. We don't know. But, you know, the more they searched around and the more they did, they just couldn't find any explanation for it at all. And as far as I know, it just kind of petered out after that and it didn't really recur. That was one of the weirdest things about that. And blood poltergeists are fairly uncommon. I described a couple other cases. There was one in France and there was one on the Ivory Coast, but you know, that where there were like blood footprints or blood handprints or just blood smears on the walls and things like that. But I'm pretty sure that this is the only case that I could find that actually consisted of just huge quantities of blood just suddenly appearing in the house with no, I mean, there was no focus. There was no particular reason why it would have happened at this particular time. It was just completely random. It's not like they had just moved into this house and
they
had been there for ages and nothing weird had ever gone on there. And just all of a sudden there's just blood everywhere. I'm amazed they have not made a horror movie out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go on to the whole fire chapter. I was wondering as we were going through this, I mean, you're talking about people who seem to be manifesting fire unconsciously, that if there's any connection between that and spontaneous human combustion.
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that, because normally, I mean, in a lot of these fire cases, the ones that were purportedly not hoaxes, it's quite rare for the fire to manifest on a person. It does happen, but on the rare occasions when it does happen, usually the person isn't burned, which I find that very instructive, that maybe the focus or whoever is causing these fires to start, they understand. I mean, obviously they don't have any compunction about burning whole houses down, because that does happen. That did happen on several occasions, but it's almost like they draw the line at actually hurting someone. Hmm. You know, it doesn't usually happen. I don't think I came up with any cases where there was a fire poltergeist that actually set fire to anyone and hurt them. It's usually people's clothing will catch fire, but it doesn't burn them.
Yeah, and that's weird.
Yeah, it is very weird.
Well, let's look at the case of the Macomb, Illinois fire starter, because that was especially extreme.
Yeah, this one was almost like Firestarter, really. The focus was a 13-year-old girl. This happened in Macomb, Illinois in 1948. And she was 13, and her name was Wannett McNeil. And she, she was having a lot of problems, a lot of emotional problems. Her parents had divorced, and she had been sent to live with her father in this real rural town in Illinois. She had wanted to stay with her mother in Bloomington, I believe they were from. But she got sent out to this farm away from all her friends and stuff like that. So she was not happy about it. So she had been there for a little while, and then the family started to notice these little brown spots were appearing on the wallpaper. And these spots would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then suddenly, you know, and then they would start to smolder, and then they would burst into flame. And this happened for a few days, and everyone started kind of getting curious. You know, so all the neighbors kind of heard about it, and they all came over, and they all brought water just in case the house caught fire so they could put it out and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they said it was getting to the point where just these little fires were just popping out just all over the house. I mean, to an extent where it seemed unlikely that just one person was just running around the house setting them, especially since there were so many witnesses around now, because there were all these neighbors that had come out to see it.
Right.
So they eventually called out the fire marshal, and his hypothesis was that maybe someone was putting some kind of flammable chemical on the wallpaper, or maybe the wallpaper had come with some kind of flammable chemical on it, and it was just causing these fires. So he told the family, we'll take the wallpaper off and your problem should be solved. So the family takes down out all the wallpaper. And it didn't help. So then the bare plaster started catching on fire. So, you know, at this point, the insurance companies got involved. They had the wallpaper analyzed, and they said not only were there no flammable chemicals in the wallpaper, but the wallpaper had actually been treated with a flame retardant chemical. So it wasn't even supposed to catch on fire at all. So then the fires kind of spread to other places, like the curtains would start to catch fire, the mattresses would start to catch fire. The family had to eventually move out to a large garage on the property because they just couldn't deal with all these fires starting in the house. Now, this all happened over the course of about a week. And it only took a week from the time that the manifestation started to the time when the entire one of the barns on the property burned completely to the ground. And the day after that, there was a little milk house on the property that also burned to the ground. And then a couple days later, the chicken coop burned to the ground.
Man.
And witnesses reported that, you know, all of these fires had been going on. So there were neighbors with water. There were firefighters, you know, kind of at the ready. Mm-hmm. And they all had fire extinguishers and stuff like that. Witnesses reported that even though they tried to put the fires out with fire extinguishers, that it didn't help. It didn't do anything. The fires just kept on burning.
Hmm.
So at this point, I mean, at this point, everyone in the area had heard about this and everybody was coming. They said it was just like a circus. There were people camping out in the yard and things like that. And everybody kind of had ideas about what was causing it and stuff like that. The Air Force was saying, oh, maybe it's the Russians, you know, spraying us with radiation, or, you know, maybe there's aliens and it's a death ray. Who knows? So at this point, though, the fire marshal, and this was the state fire marshal, he said, you know, I think it's that teenage girl doing it. So he actually took her into custody and subjected her to intense questioning, quote unquote. So they interrogated her for quite a while. Now, they claimed that after they interrogated her, that Wannett confessed that she had started all these fires herself with matches.
Hmm.
She said she was angry because she had been forced out on this farm and she had wanted to stay with her mother and all these other things. Now, I don't know about this. And a lot of people at the time said, you know, there was no way that she could have started all these fires.
Right.
They said, one thing, there were so many witnesses around that saw fire spontaneously bursting out of the wall when the kid wasn't even around. You know, and they're like, where would this girl have got all these matches? You know,
yeah.
Nobody smelled any matches. You know, they smell like sulfur when they go off. And so it just seemed like maybe they had talked her into confessing just so they could kind of put the whole thing behind them. So it was kind of unresolved. I mean, if it was legitimately paranormal, I mean, obviously it was her doing it because she was so traumatized and, you know, just emotionally messed up at the time. I have a hard time believing that all of it was faked.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that she might not have done it a couple of times, but for fire to burst out of the wall, you know, to burst out of bare plaster, to burst out of wallpaper that supposedly had flame retardant paste on it, that seems a little difficult to pull off for a 13-year-old kid. I mean, if you throw a match at the wall, it doesn't really do, it just goes out.
It would be hard for anyone to pull off.
Yeah. So that's why I kind of think that maybe they said, you know, why don't you just say you did it and we'll just, you know, we'll just clear up these insurance claims and everyone will go away and it'll be fine. So I kind of think that's what might have happened there because they didn't know how to explain it. So they said, well, she did it, case closed.
Yeah.
But I kind of find that hard to believe.
And what was the ultimate resolution? Did it just stop because she moved away?
Yes, she moved away. She went to live with her grandmother, who she evidently liked a lot better than her father. And she kind of settled down and got over her anger and stuff like that. And the fire stopped. And the man who owned the farm, it was her father's brother or something who owned the farm. He got an insurance payout. So evidently the insurance company was willing to take that. Yeah, she set all the fires. It's arson here. So they paid for everything. But yeah, she moved away and the fire stopped after that.
Okay. Let's go back to the one I mentioned earlier, the Caledonia Mills in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, this was a little bit similar, kind of. This is usually, it's also called the Fire Spook of Caledonia Mills or the Antigonish Haunting. And this was this also took place on a farm. I don't know why so many of these took place on a farm, but they really do. Not just the fire ones, a lot of the other manifestations too. But this one happened in 1921. This one didn't actually start with fires. The first thing that he noticed was prank type stuff. He would the farm equipment would be moved around. The horses and cows, their tails would be braided. The livestock would be switched around in their stalls. There would be ash in the milk containers and things like that. So, you know, at first he just thought it was somebody, you know, playing a prank. It was one of the farmhands or something like that, even though they all denied it. And then it kind of started getting worse. Like the livestock would be let out of their pens. They'd all be running around when he got up in the morning, and they would all, they would be set loose, and they would be, all worn out. They'd be all sweaty, and their eyes would be rolled back in their heads as if somebody had run them around all night. And to kind of see what was happening, he said, well, what we're going to do, we're going to put all the horses and cows, we're going to put them in their regular stalls, and we're going to chain them to the floor. And they just bolted. They had these big rings, and they bolted the chains to the floor. They said, now let's see if they get out of the stalls this time. But they did. So obviously at that point, he knew that it couldn't have been a prank, you know, because what did somebody just have these big thing where he was just cutting chains and letting all the horses and cows loose? So at this point, after he determined that it wasn't a prank, then the fire manifestation started. And the first thing that happened in the early part of the year. It was in January, and he came downstairs and he was going to light a fire in the stove, you know, before his wife got up so she could cook on it. And then he saw that the range still had cinders on it as if it had been burning. And he said, you know, that's funny because we put that out last time. You know, they always put the stove out before they went to bed. And then he looked up and saw that the ceiling over the stove was glowing. It was red as though it had been on fire and it was just burning out. And so he's looking up at that going, I wonder what that could be about. And then he heard behind him, he heard like a whooshing noise, like fire coming out of it. And then he felt heat on his back, and he turned around, and there was a chair in the kitchen, and it was on fire all of a sudden. So he picked it up and he threw it out in the snow. And as soon as he had thrown the chair out in the snow, then a sofa in the same room also spontaneously caught fire. So at this point, they're like, well, okay, let's take everything apart. We'll take the stove apart. We'll take all this other stuff. Maybe there's some kind of cinder ember getting out and it's catching things on fire. So he took the entire stove apart and put it back together. They couldn't find anything unusual. So the end of that day came. They went to bed. Now, in the middle of the night, they started smelling smoke again. So they went downstairs and the whole kitchen was on fire. It was actually the boards around the fireplace. So he put that fire out. And then fires just started everywhere. They started happening all over the place. And then it was the same thing coming out of the wallpaper. It was coming behind the wall behind the stove. It was just coming out of the walls, coming out of the ceiling. And sometimes it would happen. It wasn't even things that were flammable. Like at one point there was a bowl and it had water in it and there was a washcloth in there. And the wet washcloth caught fire. witnesses came by and saw this. And they also saw, they said, now sometimes when you looked down the hall into a room, you would see kind of a blue-white kind of light, you know, like a very, very hot fire or something like that. They said it looked really strange. So they didn't know if it had anything to do with the fires or not. So at this stage, the family, who were called the McDonalds, they actually went to stay with the farmer's brother. Now, nothing happened when they were there. And when they got back to the house, no fires also started. No fires started after they got back to the house. So it's almost like them leaving kind of stopped it.
Yeah.
Now, afterwards, they had a couple other little things happen. They had a couple people said they felt like slapped and heard funny noises and things like that. And they actually called in some investigators, and they called in a psychic who said that the psychic seemed to think that a supernatural entity was causing the fires. But the parapsychologist they summoned, who was investigating the case after the manifestations had stopped, he thought that the farmer's daughter, Mary Ellen, who was adopted, that she was the one causing the fires, but that she was doing it unconsciously.
Right.
Like she, not so much that she was doing it like pyrokinesis, but that she was doing it like in a fugue state. Mm. She was getting up and again, you know, he had some kind of reason for thinking that. He said, well, none of the fires started where she couldn't reach it. And in the house, we found a bottle of flammable liquid that she could have been using. You know, maybe she just soaked a rag in flammable liquid and, you know, started the fires that way. And, you know, the other stuff with the livestock, it's, you know, she's like, maybe she did it, or maybe, you know, that it wasn't as bad as it was reported or something like that.
Right.
But, and kind of also bolstering his assertion, now there weren't any fires for a very long time, for probably about 3 or 4 months after the McDonald family came back from their brother's house. But in September, the fire started again. Now this time, they caught Mary Ellen starting a fire in the barn.
Mm.
So they, because she had some emotional problems, some mental disabilities, they actually sent her to a hospital in Nova Scotia. But again, just as in the last case, although they did catch her one time, the fires before, many of them had started spontaneously when she was not there, when she was asleep. And the sheer number of them and the number of people that witnessed them starting would seem to suggest that maybe they were starting spontaneously to start with. And then, you know, like we were discussing on the show before, maybe she wanted attention again. And she said, yeah, I'm going to start a fire physically. Whereas I don't know if she was before, because as I said, you know, the first fires that started were only witnessed by the farmer and no one else was there. You know, everyone else was asleep. The little girl wasn't around. So it wasn't like she was just sneaking up around behind him and starting a fire and things like that. So this is kind of maybe one of those cases where she was caught faking, but only faking because she wanted all the attention to return.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Because it was drying up. The attention was drying up.
And the other thing in that whole story that I found interesting was the braided horse tails, which is something you get a lot in fairy lore as well as Bigfoot stories.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So and it's maybe some kind of crossover there that it's definitely, I mean, poltergeist phenomena definitely does seem to have a prankster aspect.
Oh yeah.
Of that kind of thing. And so maybe who knows? Maybe all the fairy things that people are seeing too, with all these like knots being tied and people's hair and stuff like that, that could be some kind of extension of poltergeist phenomena. Who knows?
And one of the unusual ones in the fire chapter was the case of, I'm going to say it wrong, the town in Italy.
Yeah.
Canneto di Carolina or Caronia.
This was completely bizarre, and this doesn't usually happen. And this is fairly recent. This happened in 2004. It's a little seaside town in Sicily. And for whatever reason, in early 2004, people in town, 12 different people, reported that spontaneous fires had started in their houses. And it wasn't a case of fire coming out of the walls. It wasn't a case of, you know, a pile of paper or a pile of oily rags or whatever. It was usually appliances, which I thought was very bizarre. They reported at one house a stove caught fire, one a vacuum cleaner caught fire, one a refrigerator caught fire, a bundle of unplugged electrical cables, a pile of wedding presents. Just strange things like that, you know, just a piece of furniture would suddenly catch fire. 12 different houses. So since so many people were reporting it, they called in the Italian power utility, who obviously said, well, there has to be some kind of electrical anomaly in the whole village. I mean, it's not a huge village. So they came in and started an investigation, and they actually turned off all the power to the town at the source. And it had no effect whatsoever. Fires still continued to start. And then the mayor and everyone got involved, and they said, you know what, we're just going to evacuate the whole village until we find out what is going on. So they made everyone leave their houses and go stay somewhere else while they tried to root out what was causing these fires to pop up everywhere. And they found nothing. No evidence of arson, no nothing. And they even had a fire breakout at the water pipeline station in town. And they contacted they contacted the military, they contacted engineers, they contacted geologists, and no one could figure out what the hell was going on. And the best they could come up with, maybe it's volcanic. That was about it. I mean, Mount Etna wasn't that far away. It's like, maybe, who knows? But that's about all they could come up with. I mean, other than some people have said, oh, maybe it's UFOs, maybe it's the other type of thing like that. But and I think this was actually the funniest thing, too. I think more than one person said, well, maybe there's some kind of supervillain around here that has some kind of Tesla-style technology that's testing it, and they're just kind of starting all these fires in the town, which I was like, oh, I hope that's true, but I bet it's not. I bet it's not. But yeah, so, you know, likely, since no naturalistic explanation can be found, I'm imagining it might be some kind of poltergeist type activity, although unusual because no focus, no reason necessarily, and it was just a whole town that just kind of spontaneously had all these things happen all of a sudden. Now, the initial salvo of the fires went on from, I believe, January to August 2004, and they kind of petered out after that. But then in 2014, they started back again. The people's cars would catch fire, clothing would catch fire, not while it was on anyone.
Well, that's good at least.
Yeah, and the townsfolk were evacuated once again, but still nothing. And also, I should note, too, that the entire town was rewired. Like, they upgraded the power grid, and they rewired all the electricity and everything. So they weren't screwing around. I mean, they wanted to figure out what this was. So they went the distance and tried to figure out what it was, but it didn't seem to have any effect whatsoever. So unless it's some kind of volcanic something, some kind of volcanic anomaly, I really can't imagine what else could be causing that.
And that seems like a stretch at that, too.
It does. Yeah, that's pretty much the only naturalistic explanation I can think of.
Unless, you know, the United States is doing some kind of weird experiments.
Yeah, that's possible, too. That would surprise me.
All right, let's move on to the whole apparition poltergeist crossover. And apparitions are not generally a part of poltergeist encounters, correct?
Not usually. And usually when people do see apparitions, they tend not to be of a recognizable person. It does happen on occasion, but usually if apparitions are seen, it's usually just a shadow or a ball of light, or some kind of amorphous fog or something like that. It's not usually, you know, a ghost, quote unquote, that looks like an actual person or, you know, someone that would be recognizable.
And so let's start off with one of these accounts, which I love. This is one of my favorite of all time, is the Dalby Spook, or Jeff the Mongoose.
Yes, this was one of my favorite cases, too. It's like, even if it's not true, I don't even care. I was like, I wasn't going to put this in the book at first, but then I was like, this is so adorable, I just have to put it in there.
And it's definitely very, very weird, if there is any truth to it whatsoever.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the stranger haunting cases, just because it seems like such a random apparition to see, and the way it acted was just very bizarre. It's almost so bizarre that I don't know why anyone would make it up or how anyone would make it up.
Yeah.
You know, because it just seems so strange. Why would you make up something like that? But yeah, this, it happened in 1931, and it happened also on a farm again. Why? I don't know why so many of these happen on a farm. I'm not sure. I'll have to look into that. That'll be my next. Why do ghosts haunt farms? But yeah, so there was a farm, and it was on the Isle of Man, and it was kind of, you know, out on its own. And this was the Irving family, and they had a 12-year-old daughter, and her name was Vori. And they moved out to this farm. The father, Jim, had been a salesman, and they moved out to this farm to kind of see if they could, you know, make a go of farming and in his twilight years or whatever. But the farm didn't do very well, and they were losing money and things like that. So I guess there was kind of a lot of stress on the family. Now, it happened that they started hearing strange noises behind the walls, like scratching or something like that. So they thought at first, obviously, it was rats. So they put out traps, and they never caught anything. And then after a while, the scratches started getting louder, and then it started growling. And Jim was like, I wonder what that could be back there. And then he started making a game of, he would growl at the thing behind the wall, and it would growl back at him. And then he would make some kind of animal noise at whatever this was behind the wall, and it would make the same noise back, like it was mimicking him. So he thought that was very strange. So kind of as time went on, you know, after a few weeks of this kind of mimicking animal sound game, this thing behind the wall started to talk. And it had this little bitty squeaky voice. And it was first started to sing. It was singing little nursery rhymes and things like that. And then it said that it was a quote-unquote extra clever mongoose. And that his name was Jeff, and that he had been born in Delhi, India, in 1852. Now, I thought this was very weird when I read this. I was like, a mongoose of all things. Why a mongoose? Yeah. Well, it turns out it's not as weird as it sounds, because evidently someone who had lived in the area previously, they had had a problem with a rabbit outbreak. There was, you know, there were so many of them, they'd become a pest. So he had imported some mongooses to kill the rabbits. So there had been a few of them had escaped. So there had been like a few little mongooses living wild in that area, evidently. That's the story anyway. So mongoose, it's not as weird as it initially sounds. But yeah. So apparently the entire family heard this voice talking. Now, the farmer and his wife, Jim and Margaret, they only saw Jeff out of the corner of their eye. He was just kind of like a little skittering shadow or whatever. Now, the daughter said that she saw him quite clearly. And she said that he was larger than a rat. He had kind of yellowish fur and a little bushy tail. And she even kept a little box in her room that he evidently slept in. Or I don't know if she saw him sleeping in there or if she just assumed that he slept in there. I don't really know. But she left it there for him. And so one of my favorite things about this story is that Jeff apparently talked a lot, and he would just sit behind the wall and he would entertain the family with various little songs and whatnot. And he said that he would go out of the house and he would hang on to the axle of the bus that was going down into town. And he would ride down into town in the day, and he would kind of mess ass around town and listen to all the gossip from, you know, all the townspeople and stuff. And then he would return home on the bus at the end of the day, and then he would regale the Irving family with all the gossip about town that day, about this person's doing this and this person's doing that.
Right.
So I kind of love that, the idea of a little ghost monk who's riding under a bus down to town and just listening to everybody. It's, what's going on? But yeah, that was very funny to me. And another thing that was very funny to me, and I swear Tom and I still do this, is that evidently at the end of the day, when Jeff was done with his talking for the evening, he would announce that he was done by saying "vanished," and then he would stop talking. So yeah, so every now, so that's become a thing like in our house now, is every time we're leaving the room, we're going "vanished." I'm leaving the room. So now evidently, I mean, obviously this apparition was not scary to them.
Right.
That it did do some poltergeisty type things, like it threw a bowl one time and it kind of would throw things around every now and then. And every now and then he would get a little angry and he would like call Jim names and he would sing dirty limericks because he knew that that would make Margaret upset. So he would do little prank type things like that, but nothing super harmful. And apparently he would do some really helpful things too. Like sometimes he would go out and evidently he would kill a rabbit and he would bring it back for the family to eat and things like that. And the family said that they would sometimes leave little things out for him, like chocolate or whatever. And, you know, so because it was kind of a small town, the story about the mongoose kind of got out. And so Vori, the daughter, she started getting bullied at school because, you know, everyone was teasing her about the mongoose.
Sure.
Stuff like that. And then some reporters came and said, well, we think it's a hoax and the voice is just her. You know, she's just doing like a little ventriloquist thing for attention or whatever. So, and it kind of came out in the press like that. So she wasn't having a good time at school. So in order to sort of, you know, get some vindication, Harry Price, who's quite a famous paranormal investigator, he heard about the case and he wanted to come out and investigate it, but he, you know, he was engaged at the time. So he sent one of his colleagues, and the colleagues went out there and they tended to think that it might have been a hoax because, one, Jeff did not talk while they were there. And also they asked if there was any kind of evidence or anything like that that the family could provide. And the Irvings gave them a little bit of fur and said that it was from Jeff. Now, when they had this fur analyzed, and keep in mind, this was, you know, 1921, so we don't know how good the analysis was, but when they had the fur analyzed, they said, well, it's probably dog fur. And they said that they noted that the Irving family did have a sheepdog named Mona. So they said, well, maybe this fur is just from the sheepdog. So, and they also had a footprint. You know, they took a cast of a footprint that was supposedly Jeff's footprint, and they figured that might have been a raccoon.
And again, it's sounding like a Bigfoot story.
It is, yeah, yeah. And, you know, after the investigation, because Harry Price eventually did go out there and investigate for himself, he didn't really take a stand on whether it was a hoax or not, and he actually did end up writing a book about the case later on. But, you know, he stayed neutral about whether he's like, yeah, it could have been a hoax, might not be. He didn't seem to think that it was actually a ghost of a mongoose that was from India that could talk. You know, he was
right.
He was kind of the opinion, well, it might be a poltergeist outbreak that was caused by Vori, that was how it was manifesting itself for some reason, that it's manifesting itself as a talking mongoose. And that was pretty much, I mean, after the paranormal investigators were there, the voice kind of petered out. And they didn't really hear it much anymore. And they actually tracked down Vori when she was grown up in 1970 and asked her about it. And she was very insistent that it was not a hoax, that this was an entity that had been in her house. And she seemed ambivalent about it. She said, well, I wish it hadn't happened. It wasn't a very pleasant experience, not so much because of the actual entity, but because of how she was treated because of it. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you know, whether that was an actual entity, whether it was a poltergeist that was coming from her and just for some reason took this bizarre form, who knows? But yeah, that was definitely one of the more entertaining stories that I researched for this book.
And it does fit the patterns. It's just that you don't normally get a mongoose, especially one that's as playful as Jeff was.
Yeah. And that might be down, if it is a poltergeist manifestation, that might be down to the focus's personality. Maybe that was just how particular energy manifested itself. Maybe she was just kind of a funny, playful type of person, and that was how it came out.
All right. Well, let's see. What else do we got here? Let's hit one more, and then we'll take a quick break for the next part. Let's talk about Brother Dolly.
Okay. This one is actually, this is another kind of strange one, and this one is sort of a little bit kind of close to my heart because it took place in Wales, and I lived in Wales for a little while. This one started out not so much like a poltergeist infestation. This actually started in 1997, and it happened in North Wales. There was a house owned by a family called the Gowers, and evidently there were some Irish tourists who were walking in a field near the Gowers' house, and these tourists said that they saw a vision of the Virgin Mary in this particular field, and they wrote into a newspaper talking about it. Now, initially, the Gower family very publicly said they thought the whole thing was silly and they didn't see anything and all this other stuff. So even though they thought it was crap, like they thought it didn't happen, the Rosemary Gower, she kind of still got interested in the paranormal and wondered if there was something going on around the property. So she started taking photographs around the property. Now, in some of these photographs, she alleges that she saw faces that weren't there when she took the pictures. And one of these pictures in particular that she took of a barn window, she says it looks like a woman's face. And she said, oh, well, it's the Virgin Mary's face. So she started to kind of get more on board with the whole Virgin Mary idea. Now, after that picture was publicized, it kind of got around in the area and people started coming there and making it like a pilgrimage area and leaving flowers and things like that. So at first the Gowers were like, well, we don't really like all these people trooping through our field. But after a while, it was just, they weren't causing any harm. You know, the people that were coming, so they said, okay, it's fine. So it's weird because if that was all there was to it, it's, you know, because so many people claim they see the Virgin Mary and, you know, everybody starts pilgrimaging there and whatever. But
yeah,
but after that happened, evidently, I don't know if it had to do with the family getting interested in the paranormal suddenly because this alleged Virgin Mary sighting, but apparently poltergeist stuff started happening in the Gower house shortly afterward. And one of the weirdest things that was reported, Rosemary reported that she had set down a vase full of flowers while she was cleaning the windowsill or something like that. And when she turned around, all the flowers had died and the buds had fallen off and had turned into dead wasps, which I thought was very weird. It's like kind of a horror movie kind of image there.
Yeah.
And also they had an adopted son, and this son also said that he saw some apparitions. That what the one that he saw in particular was called the Blue Lady, and he thought that it was perhaps Mother Teresa. Now, they also had a bunch of other stuff happen inside the house, and the most common thing that would happen was that words would appear on the walls. And these words were usually in Welsh. Now, the Gower said they did not speak Welsh. So you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but they said they didn't. So they didn't know what any of these words meant, and they had to have someone translate them. And also a few times there was the image of a monk or something that kind of looked like a monk would appear on the walls. And they would sometimes see an apparition of a monk walking around the property. And it was this monk that they started to call Brother Dolly, Dolly being short for Adolphus. So they were not afraid of this. They thought it was a good thing. And they were very amused by the fact that all these words that had started appearing on the wall, after a while, the alleged monk would sign them with Dolly. Like, he liked the name that they had given to him. Right. So, yeah. So at this stage, the case had become quite famous. It had been on a lot of TV and newspaper and stuff in England and Wales. And then a lot of other weird stuff started happening. Like, Rosemary would send someone an email, and in the email there would be all these Welsh words like transposed into her text that were just stuck in there at random. And she claimed that she did not type them in there. And reportedly, when they checked her sent folder, the emails that she wrote did not have those Welsh words in there. Hmm. And they also had, you know, sometimes she would print out a document and it would also have Welsh words sometimes going sideways or upside down or things like that. Like, they were interpolating themselves into her technology. And there were also things like, you know, words were carved out in the yard and things like that. And they also had other kind of like classic poltergeist type phenomena, flickering lights. The clocks would run too slowly. Phone calls would be made from the house when no one was in there. Strange voices, like a baby crying, banging footsteps, cold spots. They would smell wax or incense when neither of those things were present. And at this point, they had a parapsychologist come from the Society for Psychical Research. Now, this parapsychologist discovered some interesting things that led him to believe this might have been a hoax as well, but he wasn't willing to go all the way and say that it was. He said, well, for one thing, he asked Rosemary for the negatives of a bunch of the photographs she had taken around the property, which supposedly showed faces and the Virgin Mary and things like that. And she said that she did not have them anymore. Hmm. And the one negative that he was provided with, he said it looked like the face had been either painted on a mirror or smeared on there with lotion. He wasn't entirely sure, but he said that's how it could have been done. He also noted that a lot of the Welsh words that appeared on the walls, some of them had particular misspellings. Now, he said that if this was a spirit that was supposedly a Welsh-speaking spirit, it's unlikely that they would make these particular spelling mistakes.
Right.
There was also the case of they set up cameras all around the house to see if they could catch any of these drawings or writings spontaneously appearing on the walls. And they said while the cameras were running, they didn't get anything. They didn't see anything appearing on the walls. Now, while they were filming, allegedly a cross appeared on the wall. And at first they were really excited because they said, oh, we caught that. The cameras were running. Okay, but then it turned out that when that cross appeared, the cameras had been off. The Gower family said, oh, we had a power outage. It was only out for 2 minutes. That must have been when it happened. But when they checked the tapes back, the power had actually been out for 2 hours. So, And when the video was watched back, they said it looked like the camera had been moved slightly from its initial position. So they said it's possible that someone could have turned the camera off, painted or drawn something on the wall, and then turned it back on. And then said, oh, it was a 2-minute power outage. They also caught footage of the son sort of doing weird things around the wall, and it looked like he had kind of a piece of charcoal in his hand or something like that. However, it should be noted that a lot of the early things that appeared on the walls were not done with charcoal. They couldn't be rubbed off. They almost looked like they had seeped out of the wall. So this, again, might have been a case of maybe these weird things were happening at first and then they stopped. And then someone felt like, oh, well, we need to continue it. So then they started faking it. It could be that that's the case. And the parapsychologist also noted, he said, now some of the early appearances of the drawings and the words were in places where a person couldn't really get to very easily. Like it was like behind a real awkward, like heavy appliance or something like that. He said, whereas a lot of the later ones were always in really convenient locations. So it did seem that at least the later ones were maybe faked, but the earlier ones, you know, it was more ambiguous whether they were faked or not. But, you know, at this point, it was like the parapsychologist did actually see a few odd things. Like he saw one of his bags move from one location to another, and he received a strange email from Rosemary with all these weird Welsh words in it, even though she wasn't sitting at her computer at the time. Like he received it while she wasn't sending, you know. So
and that's particularly weird.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of one of the weirdest. I mean, particularly if it's true that when they checked her messages in the sent folder, they didn't have these words adulterated in them. And like I said, it also appeared on documents that she printed, and the words would be upside down or along the side or things like that. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where could be one thing, could be another thing. And the parapsychologist did see a couple of strange things. He did take a photograph when he didn't see anything on the wall. And then he said after he had the film developed, he saw a little something on the wall that looked like a monk that hadn't been there before. And this all went on until about 2001, at which time Brother Dolly apparently told the family that their son was too old now and didn't need him anymore, and that he wasn't going to come back. Now, the family have said that they occasionally see other apparitions. Rosemary has said that she's seen a boy with long hair and that sometimes she sees a pregnant woman, but it's gotten to the point where it's very rare nowadays. Although I believe it's still a bit of a pilgrimage area because of the initial Virgin Mary sighting. So I think some people still do go there and leave flowers and whatnot.
Huh. You know, even if we can figure out, you know, how, I don't know. It's one of those weird things, like these things seem to have such a personality of their own.
Yeah.
Especially in certain cases, that it's really hard to figure out what exactly is happening.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, this case in particular, it seemed like a lot of the early stuff was more ambiguous, like it could have been something paranormal going on. The later things, it really did seem like probably the son was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's really no telling. It's kind of like a lot of the cases that are in this book. I know it's kind of unsatisfying, like to say at the end, it's like, well, it just stopped and it could be this and it could be that. But I mean, that's kind of how it happens in real life. It's like, you never really know what's causing it. And, you know.
Yeah, we did a show on fiction and the paranormal, and you know, I mean that's one of the things is that paranormal encounters tend to peter out.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter what it is. There's usually not some big crescendo at the end.
Yeah, and I do think and I did think of that while I was writing the book. I was like, well, maybe people that read a lot about the paranormal probably know that, but I'm just kind of like, well, people that are used to seeing horror movie adaptations of supposedly true hauntings and paranormal or poltergeist infestations are probably used to like this big buildup, you know, getting to this big climax at the end. And very, very rarely do they get like that. They usually start pretty lame. And sometimes like a couple big scary things happen. And then it just kind of, it either stops abruptly or it just kind of, you know, withers away.
Or the entire farm burns down.
Or the entire farm burns down and several other buildings on the property.
I would think that's one of the rare crescendo cases where everything's just lost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's definitely the type of poltergeist infestation you don't want right there. It's like, well, my entire house and my entire barn and everything burned to the ground.
Yeah, I can deal with stuff moving. I can deal with weird noises. But when things start setting themselves on fire,
yeah,
that's a little different.
Yeah, that's definitely the kind of case where you just need to cut your losses and move out of there.
All right. Well, we'll be back with part three, and we'll deal with violent poltergeists and possessions.
Okay.
All right. And that was part two of my conversation with Jenny Ashford. Part three is next week. If you become a patron at wheredidtheroadgo.com, you have access to all the parts right away. So you'd be able to hear part three immediately, as well as the Patreon extra segment we did. I have a Patreon-only show coming up as well, where we answered some patron questions. All right. And to take you out tonight, appropriately, this is Psyche Corporation with Nightmares. See you next time.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here, among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Offering, offering, doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Rocher, éclat, a cause des ailes. Home from spectacle to primavera. Doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Now amnesia, give me an Armageddon. Give me the daring to forfeit ordinary dreams for the cost of pleasing humans far too steep. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires. Door, it's under the floor, the monster's there, yeah, yeah.